accession number 18528, reel 2.
Derry Councillor, reel 2.
Mount Pecan. We had to take it literally in a hand-to-hand situation. The Germans were very stubborn, although they had left the immediate peak of the hill, they were in the surrounding areas. One of the problems we had when we eventually took the hill was the fact that we could not dig in because of the white chalk. It was impossible to dig in. And so we were exposed to what could have been a rather difficult situation had the enemy counterattacked with artillery fire.
Can you describe the fighting at this mountain?
It was hand-to-hand. One or two battalions did literally have to fight each yard, as it were. The 4th Battalion, I was in B Company, and I was one of the leading companies. Oddly, that my job at that particular time was a platoon runner, which was meant that I had to sort of run between the company headquarters and the platoon headquarters to give oral messages or whatever. And I had the privilege of finding myself walking up the summit with the CO, Colonel Lucy, up to the top. We encountered many German corpses and wounded in the course of that particular battle. We sustained a few casualties, not as many as we'd feared we would have done, but we did have some casualties. But prior to that, the Germans had counterattacked before Mount Pecan, and I have to tell you that out of a total of 35 or 30 men, if you like, that transferred from the Beach Group to the Wiltshires, on that particular day, there was only about 10 of us left to tell the story.
What impression did you form of the soldierliness of the opposition?
Very good. They were very good. They were crack troops.
Did you know anything about which units?
Yes, we were told they were SS and the 21st Panzer Division. There were about 10 to 12 German divisions, or more, much more, actually opposing the British Army and the Canadian Army at that particular point. It was a strategic design to give the Americans an opportunity to swing around to the right. So we took them all on, a lot. And so, of course, we were up against the crack German troops.
What impression did you form of the leadership in this battalion?
Our battalion, very good. Very good. Very great example of courage and determination. In all ranks, I'd say in all ranks relative to non-commissioned officers up to company commanders.
What happened next that you remember?
Well, after that particular battle, of course, it was another big battle there afterwards at Vernon, which was the last river before crossing into towards Paris. Again, we had problems there. Quite a number of casualties. In fact, one particular chap got in touch with me and he wanted me to tell him what transpired, because at that particular point he had been exposed to a series of bombardments and the shells had exploded and caused him to have loss of memory at that point in time. He was invalided back. He subsequently wrote to me many years afterwards asking me, could I recall? Well, it so happened that the book I've got did give a detailed account of the particular battle or action his company took part in. So I was able to give him some facts.
And then?
And then, after the Battle of Vernon, of course it was all hell let loose, a race towards the Dutch frontier. We went through Brussels, then there was the Market Garden, which was the airborne, Arnhem. We were involved in that.
What was your role then?
Infantry. Well, the battalion's role was, well, part of the brigade, to cross the Nijmegen Bridge in the wake of the Guards Armoured, or the American 101st, or 82nd, I should say, the American 82nd Airborne. We crossed the Escott Canal and we went on, and then that's when the problem started.
In what sense?
Well, the Germans were very much aware of what we were up to by this time, and the corridor which led from Nijmegen to the Arnhem was the central thrust for the Allied armies, and the Germans knew it. And so the Germans tried to close the gap. The 43rd Infantry Division, for better or for worse, was selected as the only division to make an attempt to relate with the airborne, literally. So the 43rd was committed, and it was absolute shambles, I have to say. All the way through, we were oust. We got to the River Lech, which was a tributary of the Rhine. Also, we had the Black Forest, or Schwarzwald, on our right. And that again was a subject of a problem because the Germans were obviously infiltrating into that. So we held the bank. Two of our battalions from the brigade went across, and we took up positions to form a bridgehead this side to receive the survivors from the airborne, including Polish troops as well. And of course, during that particular operation, I needn't tell you that was out of chaos. Aircraft were falling out of the sky and gliders were crashing everywhere. And it was quite a scene from hell, if you like, while it lasted.
Were you receiving Arnhem survivors yourself?
Yes, our battalion was, yes.
What condition were they in?
Oh, well, it was dreadful condition. In fact, I have to tell you, perhaps it's not exactly a joke, but some of the Polish troops that came towards us, we thought were German, because their helmets had eagles on the side, and we weren't sure they were SS. So there was confusion. But nevertheless, and incidentally, there is one interesting sequel to all this. We were relieved one night by the 101st Airborne Division. And we had to sort of put sandbags around our boots, tie our rifle slings, all the rest of it, and move off the position at about 12 o'clock at night. You could only move during the night, you couldn't move during the day.
What, did you still have the job as battalion, as platoon runner?
Yes, I was still platoon runner on that occasion, yes. But I had another job, actually, while we were at Arnhem, or just outside Arnhem. The battalions were linked, and I was ordered to recce between our battalion boundary and that of the adjacent battalion. Recce, see if there was anything going on between, if there was an enemy standing patrol or whatever. And I have to tell you, I crawled all the way about 200, 300 yards, and I came across corpses in the dark. Imagine what it looked like. They were German. Anyway, I did the recce, came back, and then the Allies opened up a heavy bombardment on the Black Forest. And they were firing HE. And because the trajectory was relatively low, they were hitting the tops of the trees. And on impact, they exploded. And I got a little shrapnel in my wrist here as a result of what seemingly must have been an airburst, if you like. But it wasn't a blighty. I said, no, it's not a blighty, David. You've had that. Like, I felt the trickle of blood, and the wrist went numb. It was a bit of a mess. And actually, I had a bit of trouble. Oddly enough, it fell out. So, I mean, it was a minuscule. And so I stayed where I was, and we said. However, the sequel to all that was when we marched back to, during the course of the battle at Arnhem, our section commander had about 11 bullets in his arm as a result of a German tank opened up with a Spandau. The Germans were here, and we were there. In a sort of a large, you would call it a garden centre, if you like, off Helden. The German tank was the other side. The Lance Corporal was killed, he got a bullet in the head. The full corporal, he got all these bullets, so he was out. And so the section was deprived of leadership. And I sort of found myself doing that unpleasant job of taking charge of what was left.
Where was this?
Near Arnhem, outside Elst. Mm. And so, the guy next door, two guys away, was shot and he fell dead on the parapet.
What rank did you have at this time?
Oh, yeah, private, actually. But there's an extraordinary thing. You're not going to believe this. Boy, you'll find it difficult. When I got back to Nijmegen, we marched all the way from Elst to Nijmegen in the dark. Quite interesting. We got back to Nijmegen, typical Brit Army efficiency. When we got into a rest area, right, there was an opportunity to see what was going on from the point of view of paperwork, if you like, admin. Part orders have been published that I've been promoted to full corporal. I remember the laconic comment from a sergeant. He said, "I said, well, there's no way I could judge." He said, "Yes, you can." He was a chalk or something. Chalk couple of stripes. Because I said to one of them, I said, "Have you got any needle and thread?" So I was promoted to full corporal.
Did your duties then change?
Oh, yes. I was a section commander, per se. Yeah. I'm in charge of 10 men. Or what? I were 10, just about, I think. Mm. Our various ages, incidentally.
Sorry?
Our various ages. So I took command of the section throughout the rest of the war.
Do you remember which section that was?
What, platoon?
Yes.
I wouldn't know. It'd be company, because the platoons were numbered according to the platoon. It could have been, I really couldn't tell you. I wouldn't like to hazard a guess, but it was a platoon under command of a lieutenant who had previously been in the armoured corps. Because of the shortage of subalterns, they had transferred some of the other officers from other units into the infantry, and he was our platoon commander.
What do you remember happening next?
Well, after Nijmegen, of course, the battalion went into reserve. Then we had the that business where the Germans tried to break through to the coast, remember? Battle of the Bulge. Our division was put on reserve to take up positions because the Americans were falling back. We were involved in that skirmish. And after that, of course, we prepared for Operation Veritable, which was the Battle of the Siegfried Line, and which, again, I've got a complete book about it, including what our division did. Our division eventually had to battle its way through the Siegfried Line to a place called Zanktum, which was on the Rhine, the banks of the Rhine, which was defended by German paratroopers. That was taken, we took Kalkar, we helped to take Cleve. And from there, we've crossed the Rhine in buffaloes and went into Germany. And our objective then was Bremen. We took Bremen.
Did you have much contact with the German population as you went through?
We did subsequently. After the war ended, actually. During the course of the actual battle, there was an occasion when, it's referred to in the book, actually, when we came across a village. And I was the leading section. We broke into the garden, back garden, into the house. And lying on the bed, Conrad, was a dead child, two dead children, and a woman.
How had they died?
Whether it was shrapnel or whether they were shot, I don't know. Further up the road was a woman lying in a gutter or hedge, whatever.
How much fighting was the battalion involved in as it pushed through Germany?
Quite a lot in Bremen itself, hand-to-hand fighting through the park. Again, the descriptive description of the battle we had in Bremen itself. We cleared it eventually. Ignore it.
You were just telling me about the occupation of Germany.
Yeah.
What were relations like with the German civilians?
Oh, no fraternisation, of course.
Was that observed?
Oh, yes, up to a point. Except that when the war was over, we went to a place called Vincent-on-Allach, a small village, which was, in fact, outside Belsen. Our division was responsible for the custody and maintenance of order at Belsen itself, with the 7th Army, I think it was the 7th Army Division. We took over, or it was arranged to take over, one for one.
Did you go into Belsen?
Yes, we did.
At what stage was this?
When the war was over, and we took over occupation of the, well, the Germans surrendered, because we went in. We occupied the SS barracks.
What was left of the camp by the time you got in?
Well, it was still in Situate, you know, the buildings were still there, but it was in a shocking state. We had all sorts of people there. We had UNRWA there, United Nations, all sorts of people there, Red Cross, and the army brought in bulldozers and all sorts of heavy equipment, flamethrowers, and we were all covered with white DDT powder.
Were the victims still there?
Yes, they were.
In hospital or what?
No, no, they were in the in what was left of their barracks.
And what job did you have?
Just guarding. The Red Cross and other services took over the charge of cleansing the camp. And of course, the bulldozers went in and excavated large areas to bury the corpses, or what was left of them.
So you were still with the 4th Wiltshire, is it?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Kramer, the commandant, and his crew were arrested and escorted back to a place called Celle, outside Hanover, which was referred to jokingly as the RAF Uxbridge. And he was tried and executed. Him and his wife, oh, not wife, his girlfriend, and some of the SS personnel were with him.
Now, did you stay in the army after the war?
No, I came out eventually. I went in the meantime, because after the war ended, we went to various locations in Germany, Lüneburg and places like that, and then I came out for a brief spell, and I went back in again, went to Malaya.
You rejoined the army as a regular?
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, there was nothing in Civvy Street for me.
What had been your job in Civvy Street?
Well, I worked for the Foreign Office, actually, as a clerk in the German section.
And you rejoined the army in 49?
Mm-hmm.
With the Suffolk?
The Essex, then the Suffolk.
But you went to Malaya with the Suffolk?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Can you remember which company you were in with the Suffolk?
I was in the intelligence section. Regimental headquarters.
What did that job involve?
Sorting out maps, decoding, coding, and general intelligence, regimental intelligence in general.
What was the quality of the intelligence that you were getting in Malaya?
Well, we relied basically on what the police told us, of course, the Malayan police. And also, of course, the fact that field operations were able to produce certain evidence of movement by terrorists.
And whereabouts was this that you were based?
Kuala Lumpur, Sungibisi. There you are.
Sungibisi? Oh, we'll look at the photographs later.
Yeah, but Sungibisi, which was the reputed to be the largest oak cast copper mine in the world.
Copper mine or tin mine?
Tin mine. Sorry. Yeah.
And did you have to go out in the jungle yourself?
Yes, I did.
On operation?
Yes, I did.
Can you describe what?
Well,
it
in
was
fact,
like?
I went. The picture they're taking of me. When the battalion moved up into the jungle, I was left behind to sort out all the maps and everything and put them in a relative order for them to use. And I subsequently went up front with a company. And the object of my joining them at that particular point, in that particular fashion, was I was being put on War Office Selection Board provisional test for commission. So I joined the battalion up front and a company. The platoon commander was Lieutenant Starling, who subsequently became brigade commander of an airborne over here in England. My platoon command. In fact, I have to say that the battalion earned, and there's a book here called Jungle Green, which my company commander actually wrote. There was only, that particular company was the only company, the Hell Battalion, that actually earned 3 MCs.
Which company was that?
No, you confound me again now. It could have been D Company. It could have been, I'm not sure. But that was the only company. Major Campbell was the company commander.
And you went out with that company on patrols?
Platoon. I went out with a platoon. We went out 6 weeks we spent in the jungle.
What was that like?
Well, horrendous. We were subject to all sorts of conditions with regard to the weather, background in general, and also the fact that we had to be in situate at certain spots inside the jungle on ambush situations.
Did you have any contact with the
enemy? Yes, we did. We did.
Can you describe what happened?
Well, in one particular section, I was in one particular section. The section in front of me came across some bandits who were sunbathing, of all things. Huh? That's how quiet we were. Didn't know we were there. And there was a firefight. We killed a lot.
Did you take part in that yourself?
Yes, I did. In as much that when we eventually got them all, we had to take their bodies back 4 or 5 miles through the jungle on bamboo canes.
How many of them were there?
There were four that we could account for. 3 or 4 we could account for. They were students, Chinese students. Trained by a man called Liu Kong Kim, who was the leader of the Southern Gor Gang, or Kajang Gang, as they called him. He was, incidentally, the only China one ever knew. He had a beard. Huh? And ironically enough, he was trained by the SAS against the Japanese.
Were there any casualties to
yes,
your unit?
We had one was killed by a sniper, another one was wounded.
Mm-hmm. How did they occur?
Well, on patrol.
Did you see those happen?
No, I didn't see the chap that was killed. He was killed almost a couple of days after the battalion went into the jungle. The other interesting thing that happened there was that I was on the train that was ambushed outside Johor Bahru. Oh, yes, Singapore. We left Singapore just prior to Johor Bahru. We were ambushed at night on this train. It was a passenger come through plane.
What exactly happened?
Well, they opened fire on banks, you know, high up as the train, because the train was so long and slow going up these inclines, it was easy meat. But because it was in the dark, so they were just hazardously shooting. And we shot back. We all had our own rifles. I was actually on leave from Singapore.
According to your record, you were with the Suffolks from the 30th of May 1949 to the 19th of December 1950. Mm. What was your state of health in Malaya?
Good.
Did you fall sick at all?
No. I got malaria subsequently when I came back to England.
Were you taking any prophylactic?
Yes, we were taking anti-malaria tablets. And also we took salt tablets.
What was your attitude towards the enemy in Malaya?
Contempt, actually. They were they weren't professional soldiers, they were murderers. They were killing civilians, killing all sorts. They used to ambush buses and kill them all and rob them. They were just what they were. They were living off of the local population. I think their political aspirations were guys, actually. I didn't believe it was genuine.
A guys for
doing what they were doing, pillaging. They were ruthless. They used to shoot anything and anybody. Women, children, a lot. Buses used to be ambushed. They used to kill policemen who were already shot. You know, you've no idea. Well, obviously you have no idea, but it was quite... I mean, you used to find scenes of carnage.
What did you find personally?
I fortunately didn't see some of the incidents that took place. I saw, as I say, we were fortunate enough. It was the police that got there before us. But there was a lot of evidence, of course, of what they had done, burned out huts and things.
Who were your particular friends in the unit in Malaya?
I didn't think I had any particular friends. I think it was a sort of general. We didn't personify, if you like, any particular friendship.
You didn't form groups of two?
No. Amongst the ES, Telafib, the NCOs, a couple of NCOs that I was with, we had a relationship. Because they were in the same company, same firm.
Do you remember their names?
No.
What rank did you hold at that time?
Lance Corporal, because I was in intelligence at the time. Another ironic thing here, the chap who I served with in Normandy was the intelligence officer in the Suffolks, and I met him. I was on a ship, we were sailing through port side, and I looked up casually on the bridge, and there he was standing there. He was a captain.
What was his name?
Mizrahi, Captain Mizrahi. John Mizrahi.
How did you feel about serving in Malaya?
I don't know really. I suppose it was just another country. It was just something different, I suppose. It's, from a professional point of view, it was just another job.
In the intelligence section, when the intelligence came in, what did you personally have to do with it?
If the information came through via the police, we had a police liaison officer with us. He dealt with it with the IO. I had to, on occasions, break down certain information into code. They developed some sort of code. It was easy to be broken anyway. But I had to do that. But basically, I think my job in Malaya was sorting out maps and routes and things. You know, that was really what I was doing. Because, unlike European action, there was no question of interrogation. If there were any interrogations done, it was done by the Malayans themselves. I mean, none of the British, of course, had any Chinese knowledge at all, or Malayan knowledge.
Were you glad or sad to leave Malaya?
Sad in a way, because I made some friends. I went on my own from there. I was recommended for a commission eventually. And I went back to England.
For the commission?
For a War Office Selection Board.
And when did you get the commission?
I didn't. They didn't find me suitable at the War Office Selection Board. I have to say, Conrad, I find it difficult without being sort of egotistical about this. I found it very difficult to understand, or vague, if you like, to understand why they did that. When you consider the recommendation was one which was made in the field,